Well, I'm doing a terrible job here in terms of staying with my slides. There's old disc down at the bottom of the circles in hell. And okay, here's a poem. You know this one by Leonard Cohen. Ring the bell that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's where the light comes in. That's in his album, Anthem. And this is a wonderful description of how when we are broken open, we break open to something that's already there to catch us. We fall into the psyche. We fall into the mythopoetic world. And that's what comes to meet us, the light. So now I'm going to show you just a few slides of that child between the worlds. Here's a wonderful image of the child between the worlds. A little boy bouncing. You can feel the bounce of the mattress elevating him up, gravity pulling him downward. We can imagine his squeal of delight as he enters that spot where he's in between. He's neither rising or falling, but he's suspended right there. That's the magic moment. That child that carries for Jung the divine child image is always of two worlds. And here's another wonderful example. This is from the Uffizi Gallery. Gherardo della Notte in Florence, the Adoration of the Infant Jesus. But look where the light is coming from here. Okay? This isn't coming from above, this light. The child is the bearer of the light, just like Lucifer was. Okay? Source of the light. Not the source, the bearer of the light. Here's another example of that theme of the Annunciation. Here Mary is being told that she will give birth to the Son of God, and the angel is the administer of that information. So here we have these two worlds coming together again in this announcement. This is Poussin, the Annunciation from the National Gallery in London. Now, one of the features of the divine child is that his birth is often announced in dreams. And here is Mary's dream of giving birth to the Christ child. This is in Italy, 14th century. The dream showing Christ crucified on a dreamlike tree of life growing from his mother's side. This theme that announces the birth of the child that carries the two worlds is worldwide. Here is Maya's dream of the coming Buddha, 10th century in China. The blessed Buddha's incarnation was foretold to Maya in a dream in which a brilliant white elephant with six tusks enters her womb. This dream was interpreted by the Brahmins to mean a superabundance of joy, and a son would be born that would link the two worlds. The same is true. Here's a stone carving from the second century in India of the little elephant entering Maya's womb. Here's the birth of the Buddha from the side of Maya. Now, these next few slides are simply illustrate the extraordinary nature of this child who carries the dual destiny. The way mythology pictures this is that it's a virgin birth, or it's a miraculous birth, or it's something extraordinary. It tries to give an understanding of the fact that this is not ordinary reality. This is the joining of ordinary reality with another reality. And how do we picture that? Well, by some extraordinary thing. Here's the birth of Adonis from a tree. The myrrh tree. Here's the birth of Dionysus, the second birth of Dionysus, by the way, from Zeus's thigh. Hermes is delivering the baby. If you remember the myth, while still in the womb, Dionysus was saved by Zeus when Semele was struck by his thunderbolt and died. Zeus sewed the fetus into his own thigh and carried him until it was time to be born. This is Mithra, the supreme deity of an important Hellenistic mystery religion, being born from a rock. Here he emerges with a short dagger in one hand and a torch in the other, and these allude to his roles as the bull slayer and the begetter of light. He was originally one of the major deities of ancient Iran. And the rock he was born from, very interestingly, is not just any ordinary rock. Do you know what rock it is? It's a meteor. So there again, you have the, you know, that falling from the sky, that link between the heavens and the earth. That, and meteors, by the way, have always been sacred objects for primal peoples. Precisely because of that. They come from afar. They are part of the two worlds. They embody the two worlds. And Mithra is the god that's born from that. Here's, this is 22nd dynasty in Egypt. This is a newborn god dancing on top of a lotus blossom while two female deities accompany him with music. This relief decorates the column of a birthing house, a temple dedicated to the divine child. So this goes all the way back into, and you know who this is. This is a Superman on Krypton. If you remember that story, he's born to a superior civilization in a distant galaxy, and then he comes to Earth in this pod. And before he leaves for that long journey, he's informed by his father never to apply his superior powers that come from one world to this world that he's going to, because that would violate his miraculous origins. He would lose his membership in the powers of the other world from which he came. And if you remember, he does that when his beloved, is it Lois? dies, and he, in the film version at least, he throws himself into time and space reality and reverses the Earth's spin and takes time backwards and restores her to life. And from that time on, he's lost his otherworldly powers. So these themes of the two worlds are fascinating. Here, this is an image from of the shielded dancers around the baby Zeus. The understanding was as follows. Zeus was imperiled when he was born by the powers, in this case, Kronos, his father. Here are the dancers again. Here's the father who keeps devouring his children one by one. This is Saturn or Kronos. This is Gaia's grisly image. Rhea, Zeus's mother, asks for these shielded dancers to make a huge racket and distract Kronos from the baby. And then she and Zeus eventually plot to feed Kronos a stone, which they eventually do. And I don't know what happens to Kronos as a result of this. Maybe there are better mythologists here than I am. But in any case, they get even. But the point is this. Kronos represents the resistance to coming into being of that divine child. In other words, if you have a trauma history, when you start to personalize and actualize your true self, there's a part of the psyche that doesn't want you to do that. It's the old order. You remember Herod in the Christian story, the slaughter of the innocents? This is the same here. As soon as that human divine light is born, the powers of the old order try to kill it and resist it. The patient will be sitting with you, and they will tear up, and you'll get a little glimpse through the resistance and the defenses into the true self. And as soon as that happens, they shut down again. And as one woman said to me, after a very moving session in which she was able to reach to some of these early woundings, she said, "Don't worry, I won't bring the puking, mewling little one in here ever again." So there's Kronos. There's the satanic figure that does not want that out, does not want that to get away. So these are the themes that we're going to be looking at. This is, of course, Mary and the baby, and the edict went forth from Herod. This is Reuben's slaughter of the innocents, that all children under whatever it was, 2 years of age, or were to be slaughtered. And so Joseph took Mary and the baby, and they escaped into Egypt. This is the escape into Egypt. Let's see if I can catch up with myself here. Okay, I want to give you an example of trauma and some of the life-saving energies that come through the gap that trauma breaks open. And here's the story. I told this story in my first book, but it's so good, it's so important that I'm going to tell it again. How are we doing on time? Are we? What time do we start? 7:30? We want to have time for questions, so shall we? It's 7 minutes to nine now. How about if I try to wrap this up by 9 o'clock or shortly thereafter, and then we can have some conversation? Here's the story. A little girl is told by her mother to take a message to her father, who's in the next room. And she dutifully goes off with the notepad and comes back in tears and says, "Mommy, the angel won't let me go in." Some of you are nodding. You remember this story. And the mother says, she knows her little girl is very imaginative right now. She's only 4 or 5. And she sends her back again, this time saying, "Well, you tell the angel that you have to go in and take this note to your daddy." Well, the same thing happens again, only this time more tears. So the mother takes the little girl by the hand, marches her into the next room, and through the doorway sees her husband, the drink having fallen out of his hand, dead of a massive heart attack in the chair. Now that's how defenses work. Here is a painting by Henrietta Wyeth called Death and the Child. You can see the female angel here is hiding the child's eyes from what it cannot bear, just like in our story. This is a good image for the benevolent side of what I call the self-care system. It tries to protect the innocent part of the psyche, the part that carries our spark of aliveness, our essence, from being overwhelmed by experience that's just too much reality to bear. Now, the reason I wanted to use this example is that it gives us a way to talk about the two worlds and the space between them. There are three ways to interpret this event. By the way, we don't know the end part of this story. We don't know what happened. But we know for sure that if the mother had been able to overcome her own shock and despair and able to relate to this little girl and just talk about it with her and so forth, that the angel wouldn't have had to hang around for too much longer. We also know that if the mother had disappeared into her own panic and trauma and shock, then the angel might have been more important for the little girl as a benevolent defense and would have stayed around much longer. And if that crisis resulted in maybe a major rupture in the whole family system and and this little girl had to find a way to heal herself, then that angel would have become a defense and would have sealed her off from more of your experience in the world and become a problem. It would have turned, in other words, into a fallen angel, because the light angels are fine until they encounter a trauma, and then they turn into fallen angels. And when they turn into fallen angels, they become the persecutory side of the protective system, the self-care system. So how would we interpret this event? If we looked at it through our usual materialistic, reductionistic worldview of psychoanalysis, then the child made up the angel in order to feel better. That's Freud, right? In order to tolerate the intolerable. That's all religion was for Freud, a defense against the realities of living. On the other hand, if we took a supernatural approach, like if we were all, say, sitting in an Orthodox or conservative religious group here, we might think that the guardian angel was a literal reality in the cosmos and saw this little girl's plight and came down and rescued her, and this we might think of as a miracle of salvation. So this is a conference on religion and psychology, right? So what would the intermediate reality be? How might we think about this in terms of the two worlds that we're talking about? Well, this would be a psycho-spiritual approach. It might go as follows. The guardian angel could be viewed defensively, yes, that would be, we'd give that to Freud. But then comes the question, what is it defending? And where does its uncanny wisdom and compassion come from? Could the angel then represent a universal self-protective agency from the collective layers of the psyche that intervenes sometimes in the ego's affairs when it is confronted by the too much of trauma? Here's what Emily Dickinson wrote. She said, "There is a pain so utter that it swallows substance up, then covers the abyss with trance, so memory can step around across upon it as one within a swoon goes safely, where an open eye would drop him bone by bone."